Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Akron suburb of Cuyahoga Falls grabbed the headlines recently when the use of an exercise about diversity in the middle school came to light. In the exercise, the earth is doomed, and students are asked to choose 8 people from a total of 12 characters to bring to safety on another planet. The 12 options represent an array of human circumstance, ethnicity, and race. The idea is to get the kids talking about implicit bias, and that can't necessarily be a bad thing. Joining us is research associate at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State, Kelly Capitosto. Welcome back.
Thank you again for having me.
Also joining us is Cuyahoga Falls Ward 8 Councilman Russ Iona. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I appreciate to be on.
On August 23rd, when the assignment was made public, you told the Akron Beacon Journal that you were unsure where they were going with the assignment or what purpose it was to serve. And I was wondering, what have you learned in the meantime about this?
Really, very little. What happened, a parent contacted me and sent me a copy of the assignment, and they were very upset with middle school kids addressing these issues, and their child was kind of sheepish about the whole thing, felt uncomfortable. A couple councilmen got notified. The school system basically said, before we go any further, due to union regulations, et cetera, we have to investigate the lesson plan. What transpired is on Facebook, it blew up. You had people who thought, it's not that big of a thing, and a lot of people who thought it was absolutely ridiculous, and they weren't quite sure where they were going with it. Since then, the school has come out and issued a statement that basically that assignment won't be issued again. They apologized if there was any misrepresentation of what the assignment was. It was not intended to be divisive. It was just intended to show bias. But the majority of parents that talked to me did not feel that that's what it did. And the school system basically had, I believe, talk with the teacher. They never have revealed which teacher it was publicly, and said that there'll be more constraints put on lesson plans before something like that's been given out again.
Now, before we go on, I know there's people who are listening in Akron, because I know you can get the station out there, particularly in the suburbs. So give us a call and tell us what you think about this, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So why is city council even involved in this, Russ Iona?
They shouldn't be. It's a Board of Education matter. What happens is a lot of times people don't know who are on the Board of Education. Sometimes they do know their councilman. So what happened on a citywide project, we actually have 2 school systems. We have the Woodridge School System and we have the Cuyahoga Falls School System. People reached out to local councilmen that were in the Cuyahoga Falls, and I'm also in the Woodridge School System, but they know that I had previously taught there. I'm a graduate in education, to get my take on it. My take was, it's out of context. I can't tell you if it's right or wrong. There's some things that are upsetting. They're going to turn to their councilman because they feel that's their voice and might get them heard the best. And a lot of them don't know who are on the Board of Education, realistically. They're not as visible as we are.
Right. You know, I'm wondering, and just as a politician and someone who's in public life, I read that the exercise isn't new, that it's been used before and, in fact, is kind of been around the block a few times. It's out of an institution in Texas. But do you think times are changing and people are responding to this kind of assignment differently?
Well, you're correct, but I believe it was a college assignment out of the University of Houston.
Yeah.
And this is a middle school assignment with 12 and 13-year-old kids.
Right, but it's been used before at that level.
I understand, but we have not had the kind of response we've had this time.
Right, and that's why I'm asking
you. I don't know
you.
If times are – I don't know if times – to answer your question, I don't know if times are changing or not, but it seemed that a lot of people were upset with it, maybe because they weren't sure what it was trying to do. Maybe they weren't aware it was coming out. That I can't tell you.
Is there any sense, Kelly Capitosto, that how we're whether or not, regardless, I mean, we could talk about the appropriateness and the usefulness of this assignment, and that's kind of one thing, but how we're responding to these kind of things from where you sit, is that changing?
Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting question, because reading, some of the reports and things about this particular issue, I've really been of two minds about it. Again, as you said about the issue in itself, is it appropriate? Are we utilizing tools that are best practices, ensuring that they're not reaffirming stereotypes, et cetera? But really what I've been most interested in is how the community response has been centering and what has been some of the main reason for concerns with this. And I've been a little bit concerned myself in seeing that it was really this discomfort around topics of how do we address inequity, how do we address topics of racism, of sexism in the classroom, and having those concerns being about what is really age appropriate. And I'm concerned that we're thinking that students are too young to be able to grapple with some of this content. But if we really don't start early, we're having things like social media and other forms of access to technology are going to be also informing those opinions that students have access to at a very, very young age. So I think that it really is something that schools should be taking a lot of responsibility and accounting for, encouraging these discussions in a safe and helpful environment, because I don't think students are too young to deal with the subject matter. I think that it's all around us.
And Russ, Iona, did what you heard from your constituents, was it that they just didn't like this lesson, or was it the larger question of teaching these sensitive topics and these very important topics at that age, or was it a combination? I don't know.
I think it was kind of a combination, maybe blindsided a little bit. Mm. In terms of when your child brings home that and you don't know what context it was taken into, and you're saying out of 12 people, 4 are going to die. That's the bottom line. In other words, if only 8 leave and the earth's going to explode, 4 are going to die. And which ones you pick? I think a lot of folks felt for kids that age, it was not age appropriate. Now, I'm not an expert in age appropriateness of those topics, but I can tell you a lot of people were upset with it. And maybe they felt they were blindsided and they did not think that that was appropriate, although it's not normal to get lesson plans approved by the public.
Right.
So you're in a situation that it's kind of gray area. It really is.
Hmm. I'm wondering, too, if we turned it on the other side of the coin of teaching another way is if you were left on a desert island and you had a book about all these different topics or all these different kinds of people, which books would you take with you? Then no one dies, right?
Yeah. It could have probably been done a different way. I don't think the specific situation that anyone was worried about, the sexist, the homophobia, things like that, I think what they were worried about is it was, okay, 8 people go, 4 people die. Why are we teaching that to 12 and 13-year-old kids? Isn't there a better way of approaching that subject? Not that the subject's bad, but how it was approached.
Right.
Now, again, we're taking that out of context because we weren't in the classroom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I can't tell you how the teacher taught that. And he might have had a great introduction, and it may not be as bad as it sounds. There were a couple letters to the editor commending the teacher. One was from a former teacher who said, you know, it's easy to cast aspersions when you don't know the whole lesson plan, which we don't.
A New York Times article about this, in it, someone referred to the area as Caucasian Falls. The city is about 92% white. Has this made you think about a role for city government in teaching about diversity and implicit bias now?
Well, that's kind of that Caucasian Falls was about a 1950s verbiage. That's changed tremendously. Our biggest group of population is Nepali-speaking Bhutanese, which have influxed into our area tremendously. So it's no longer Caucasian Falls. I think that's off the table. That's that's just not accurate.
Fair enough.
We're right across the street from North Akron. That part of North Akron is called an international community, and the International Institute is home to that international community. So we have refugees from the Congo, from Bhutan, Hmongs, from the former Burma. So we see a lot more diversity than ever before. I'd say the last, 15 years, tons of diversity. So I don't think that's a true picture of what Cuyahoga Falls actually is nowadays.
But do you think there's a role for city government in dealing with this issue?
Which issue are you referring to?
The issue of educating people and youngsters about implicit bias, about diversity issues, that kind of thing.
That's something the Board of Education should be involved with.
Okay.
City Council only gets that, you know, I don't want to say thrown at us, but it's handed to us when people are upset. And they automatically assume that the government and the Board of Education work together and we should be able to control that, which isn't exactly accurate all the time.
I'm going to turn to a caller now, James in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, James.
Yeah, hi, how are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Yes, I'm calling because that activity, we used it probably 30 years ago, 40 years
really?
Ago.
Really? I knew it had been around, but not that long, yeah.
Yeah, Les Brown used to do it when a lot of the programs when we work with youth, and it was really an ideal program. We phrased it a little bit different. We had children in a boat, and you had to only take so many people, and would you leave behind? But I think it's a really reality-based. I mean, our children are dealing with those kinds of things every day. I mean, look at what's happening in school systems. You know, the key to it, it just depends upon how it's set up, how the instructor or the trainer position the activity. And by people taking things out of context, of course, they're going to work with those things that they feel supports their premise. But I think it's an excellent activity. It could be done exceptionally well. Children can walk away with a lot of good information. We do a lot of work now on implicit bias.
What do you do, James? What do you do?
I'm a training consultant, and I do training on I teach probably 5 or 6 different programs on diversity and communications and conflict resolution.
And you've been doing that?
Involved in that arena.
And let me ask you, you've been doing that for how long?
40 years.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, are people responding to these topics differently in your experience than they did 30 years ago, 20 years
ago? Absolutely. Absolutely. I think situations have changed, and they are responding. I think the whole piece is there's more awareness, but what we need to also add to the awareness is consciousness, and I think just awareness alone is dangerous. Because when I'm only aware of something, then I can kind of make up in my mind what I think it is. But when I engage and when I talk and when I share information and get feedback from other people in an environment that is balanced and it's equitable where we can really talk about these things, I think people can walk away with tremendous amounts of information. And implicit bias is a major, major issue that we are confronted with as a society. It's always been there. It has always been around. But we all have bias, and it's beneficial to us as raising our own children. People have bias towards one child versus another child, you know, or the one friend versus another friend. So if done properly, it could be, it should be, it must begin to start in elementary school.
I don't mean to cut you off, but I do need to take a break right now, and I want to thank you for joining us. Thanks, James.
Appreciate
Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Russ Iona, going forward, I completely get what you're saying, and I appreciate you joining us today that, you know, government's one thing and the school district's another thing. But what are this is something that you're going to keep tabs on. Are you going to be following the district and how it approaches this topic in the future?
Yes. I think when I say yes, let me preface the yes. That's the Board of Education's job. That's the unit principal's job. That's the superintendent's job. Dr. Nichols came out with a statement that he would be monitoring things much more closely and they wouldn't have this situation again. I think that's their specialty. That's what they should be involved with. The only way a council person should be involved is like this happened, where you have people calling you or Facebook and you saying, what's going on? My job is to legislate and to make sure the city and my district moves in a positive direction for all the constituents. The Board of Education's job is to make sure the proper information is given to students. And, you know, in terms of what James mentioned about, you know, bias training, et cetera, elementary schools, middle schools, I'm sure there's a way of doing it that might have been better than what was presented. The unfair part is we don't know how it was presented.
Yeah.
So we're thrown in where we got constituents upset with it, and we have to, you know, obviously, we have to get back with them and say what we can do. Yes, I'll be paying attention to it. No, I won't actively be trying to write lesson plans at this point.
Well, Russ Iona, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Russ Iona is Ward 8 Councilman in Cuyahoga Falls, and he's one of the folks at the government level that started receiving phone calls from parents and others about a lesson plan that was used in a local middle school there, asking students to choose between a array of 12 different characters of different ethnicities, different races, different backgrounds with different circumstances in their life, and who they would take to safety on another planet when Earth was doomed. So we're going to continue our conversation about how do you teach children, when should you be teaching children about implicit bias, about diversity, when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A middle school in Cuyahoga Falls gave students an exercise. It was called Whom to Leave Behind. It instructs students to choose four people to leave behind on a doomed earth. Students must select people to leave behind based on combinations of sex, race, ethnicity, occupation, and personal experience. For example, one of the characters is a female movie star who was recently sexually assaulted. This exercise got parents questioning the appropriateness and timing of the assignment. And coming up, we're going to hear from a psychologist who can talk about that. Still with us is research associate at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State, Kelly Capitosto. Thanks again, Kelly.
Thank you very much.
And by phone, District 11 member of the Ohio State Board of Education, Merrill Johnson. District 11 includes Cuyahoga Falls. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be on the show.
You taught in Cleveland Public Schools for 40 years. What is your kind of bird's eye view of this now?
As far as the issue with the lesson?
Yes.
Well, I was listening to another caller, and it's true that lesson has been around, a similar lesson has been around for a long time. I think the difference here is the environment that we live in now in this country. I was looking at the lesson, and two of the things that bothered me were the militant African-American medical student and a Hispanic clergyman who was against homosexuality. When you put those ethnicities on those two particular descriptions, I just think that if a child, if the lesson has not been done after a number of lessons in diversity and accepting differences and tolerance of each other, you know, that's what I'm saying. If you don't know how the lesson was presented, but I just really had an issue with those two descriptions because of the ethnicity that was put on them. The stereotype is, you know, African Americans are these militant people that are violent and so forth. And when you put that right there, I just was uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, I felt like that was a really odd stereotype. I mean, they're all going to be stereotypes, right?
Yeah, but there's only three, four ethnicities. And let me just share: a militant African American medical student, a Hispanic clergyman who was against homosexuality, an Asian orphaned 12-year-old boy, and a 60-year-old Jewish university administrator. How come we couldn't have had a militant Jewish, you know, student? I mean, but, you know, I'm saying that when you place ethnicities, it just really reinforces negativity about particular ethnic groups. And I just didn't like that. But as far as the teacher using the lesson, I don't have a problem with it because I think that the teacher meant well, but again, it's out of context, and I don't know what kind of preparation or what kind of other lessons have been done around diversity, which I think is very important for teachers to be doing.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like something that is so it should be something pretty immersive, not something that's just a one-day, one-off lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kelly, I mean, what do we know about when schools should start educating students about implicit bias? I mean, when in the world would we even introduce a term like that, if ever?
Sure. I think that this conversation is really important because it gets at two sides of what we're considering appropriate. And what you're asking now is really about the age appropriateness for having these conversations versus the appropriateness of the exercise and how we create those environments. And I agree with a lot of what Meryl had to say in terms of, you know, this exercise being particularly harmful and the potential for reaffirming existing stereotypes, for the potential of creating, you know, an us versus them mentality just by the nature of the exercise. So in terms of, you know, that level of appropriateness, I don't necessarily think that that is age appropriate for or appropriate for this context, regardless of age. But when you're thinking about introducing concepts of race, of bias, of sexism and things like that into the school environment, there's a variety of research-based methodology that is appropriate at any age. And I think the more important piece of what types of lessons to introduce really should be about who we're framing this conversation around. Because so many of these activities are really about, you know, how do we raise consciousness and raise awareness for primarily white students and white audiences in general. And I think that that really kind of dilutes the nature of the points that we're trying to make because we're not getting so far into the history. We're not really getting a very nuanced picture of how we understand inequity in our society. And I think that it's very important because students with marginalized identities aren't afforded the luxury of not having to think about these things at a very early age. And we're talking about conversations not being appropriate for, you know, elementary and middle schoolers, but we're seeing things in our society where black and brown students are being the victims of violence. So I think that we're really conflating age appropriateness and revealing some implicit biases that we personally have ourselves of what constitutes age readiness for grappling with these concepts. Mm.
Yeah, there's an organization called Teaching Tolerance, which I used throughout my, the later part of my teaching career when I discovered them. And I think they are the best organization to do this. I looked up some things on kindergarten. They start teaching about tolerance and diversity in kindergarten with questions like, how can I be kind to all people? What can I do to make things fair? How do I speak up when I see people treated unfairly? Why is it scary to speak up sometimes? How can people speak up together when people are treated unfairly? And that's in kindergarten. And then they have lessons for third grade. How can I ask people about their lives and experiences in a respectful, kind, and understanding way? And then they go to ninth grade. How do our similarities and differences impact the relationships we have with people inside and outside our own identity groups? That's for 9 through 12. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's fascinating that Teaching Tolerance has been able to break down these lessons on diversity, race, and ethnicity, starting as young as kindergarten. I think it's important to start as young as possible.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about teaching about diversity and teaching about implicit bias, thinking about teaching about tolerance, when it's age appropriate, and how you do it in the first place. We're doing it because of the suburban Akron School District, where there is a bit of an uproar over a lesson plan that asked students to choose between 12 characters and who they would save and take from a doomed earth. And they represented all different ethnicities, races, circumstances, genders, and so forth. You just heard from Meryl Johnson. She's a District 11 member of the Ohio State Board of Education, also taught for 40 years in Cleveland School District. And also with us is Kelly Capitosto. She is the Senior Research Associate at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Meryl Johnson, how much does it matter the school district? Because we're talking about primarily, it's still 91.9% Caucasian school district that we're talking about in Cuyahoga Falls versus, say, a Cleveland City Schools.
Well, I think it's important because those students are certainly not going to live in a bubble. They are going to be stepping outside of their school district. And when you talk about diversity and acceptance of all ethnicities, there's so much going on now in this country. You know, they watch TV and they see the hate and hate coming from the White House. And I think it's more important than ever now for students, even if they are in a 91% Caucasian district, it's so important for them to be able to understand that hate is wrong, bigotry is wrong, and that it's really okay to accept people who are different than you.
But some people think that this is values teaching, and that's not necessarily the school's role. There has to be a conversation. I know you've had it at the state level.
Yeah, we have. We talk about it. And, you know, there's always been controversy, I think, since the beginning of time as far as what's the school's role and what is the role of the government and what is the role of home. I'm quite comfortable with taking on these roles because we have to exist within our schools and we have to make sure that students are respecting each other within the school environment. And, you know, we're teaching the whole child, so it's not just about academics and making sure you know how to read, but it's also, I feel feel like we are our character builders, and we're developing children who are going to be ready to go out into this world and be good people. We cannot, as far as I'm concerned, teachers cannot just step back and say, I'm going to leave that up to somebody else, because in many cases it's not getting done where it should be getting done.
Are there authors that you refer people to that do a good job of introducing children to these concepts without making it an assignment?
When you say authors, well, the program I mentioned, Teaching Tolerance, mm-hmm. I think is just the best way. Now, there are authors who I refer teachers to.
Okay.
And one is Lisa Delpit, who wrote a book called Other People's Children. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done with teacher training. And as a teacher, I'm not placing blame, so I don't want this to come off like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, teachers have to be prepared also to step into a classroom to be able to deal with this topic, because we have our own implicit biases. And so I think that in order for a teacher to be effective, he or she needs to have training in implicit bias, cultural competency, so that we are accepting and appreciating whatever ethnicity is in front of us. And that way, we're able to develop trusting relationships. I developed a workshop on cultural competency, and one of the things that I said to teachers is that we are the stranger in the classroom. And so it's up to us to develop those trusting relationships, and we do that by learning to appreciate and respect and understand the cultures of whatever child is sitting in front of us, and having them do the same with each other.
That's really interesting you put it that way. I'm reading a book by Jacqueline Woodson right now. It's called Harbor Me. It's a young adult novel, and that's what the school district does, is it puts this group of kids together for an hour a day and lets them talk about whatever they want to talk about, and the teacher leaves the room because for that very reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did the one thing. I would always talk about, you know, what traditions are popular in your family. Or when I would create tests, I would use the names of the students' streets. I would use their own personal names. When we, every morning for 10 minutes, I would have something called good thing, bad thing, funny thing, where anybody who wanted could share about something good or bad or funny that happened. So I was trying to build a community. I had a sign up in my classroom that said no hate zone. So the students knew that, I called them killer statements. They were not allowed to do that. And so just building a kind, respectful community where the students know that it's okay to be yourself. The teacher's going to care about us anyway, and we can trust each other. And then when you look at the number of children who are coming to school with toxic stress because of the trauma and so forth that's going on in their lives, they don't need any more stress. They don't need any more stress of somebody hating them or talking about them or making them feel unwanted and unworthy. So it puts a whole lot more responsibility on teachers, but that's why we're there. We're ready to take it on.
You know, Kelly Capitosto, what Meryl Johnson's describing is goes even beyond what I was thinking about when I said immersive kind of teaching, where it's in different curriculums and different disciplines throughout the school day. This is about an atmosphere of learning.
Yeah, exactly.
Certainly. I think that one of the most important things that we see in the research is that it's not really about all of these one-to-one lessons and educational experiences, because that's only going to be one piece of the puzzle. It's really about creating an inclusive environment that's not only equitable, but is also encouraging and uplifting. As Meryl said, paying attention to trauma, paying attention to mental health issues, to community and systemic level poverty, being able to have a variety of different staff and administrators be on board and to be that mentor, that system of support for students, is going to go much further at creating that institutional change about, you know, creating practices, such as Meryl said, having the no hate zone, that are really institutionalizing a culture around equity and inclusion.
Yeah. And one of the things I bring up all the time at the state board meetings is culturally responsive teaching, where students understand that they are empowered, and the teacher, you know, culturally responsive teaching, it liberates students. It causes them to feel free in their environment, and that would bring more joy into learning if students know that they can see themselves in the lessons, you know, this comprehensive, where you know that the knowledge and skills and values and attitudes and so forth are respecting the cultures of the the students, and the teacher is quite willing to share with the students who he or she is. The first day of every year I taught, the first thing I did was tell the students my first name. Because that's this big mystery in school, you know. And I would say, my first name is Merle. I would write it on the board, and I say, you can't call me that, but now you know. And then we'd move on. And so that, to me, that was just immediately breaking down that wall, that barrier that so often occurs between teachers and their students.
I know. I'm thinking back now, and there's some that there is no way I know their first name.
I know. You never found out, you know.
Oh, let me turn to Gail now on the phone. Hi, Gail. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Ann.
Hello.
Thanks a lot. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay. Well, this is my thought, that maybe such a project, if it were designed slightly differently, so you would really appreciate people from all different cultural backgrounds, let us say, if instead of make it also life and death, it's who you would take on a vacation with you, and then talk about things like people who are honest, you know, people who are kind, people who help neighbors, people who are bullies. In other words, a lot of different character traits. And then it seems to me the results of such a project, when the kids looked at them, they would realize, you know, when I show these character traits, people want to have me along. When I don't, they don't.
Hmm.
And then
I
you'd
like
be
that.
talking about something entirely different,
yeah,
race or whatever.
And you're saying not introduce the race card at all.
Exactly.
Okay. I hear what you're saying, and it's interesting. It sounds nice, but Meryl Johnson, is it going to still get at those uncomfortable topics?
No, I love the idea of the vacation. So it's not life or death, like who would you leave to die, you know? So
I like the idea
of the vacation, which really lightens the assignment. But you don't have to use this activity to get at the diversity. There are so many other ways through discussion and so forth that you really don't have to use this particular activity. And you don't have to put ethnicity into going on a vacation. You know, there's so many other ways to do that. I would want to say, would I want an African-American, you know, to go on a vacation with me? I think with something with that, it's more important to talk about honesty and character. And also, it'd be good for younger children, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that call. We'll continue our conversation. We'll bring a psychologist into it. So stay with us. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We are talking about teaching tolerance, teaching about diversity, teaching about implicit bias, and at what level of school it's appropriate and how it should be done, given what happened in Cuyahoga Falls recently, where a teacher did an exercise that asked the students to choose between 12 characters, that the characters were a mix of ethnicities, a mix of races, a mix of backgrounds, and a mix of experiences. And it caused a little bit of an uproar over there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about how to teach children about implicit bias, about tolerance, about diversity. A Cuyahoga Falls teacher last month used an exercise called Whom to Leave Behind, and it required the students to choose between 12 options of people, who to take and save and who to leave behind on a doomed earth. Some parents and local officials were upset with the assignment. Still with us is Senior Research Associate at Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at OSU, Kelly Capitosto. Thanks again, Kelly.
Thank you.
And by phone, Ohio State Board of Education member for District 11, Merrill Johnson. Thanks again, Merrill.
You're quite welcome. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
And joining us by phone as well is OSU Psychology Professor Antoinette Miranda. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we want to bring a little bit of the psychologist into this. What do we know about what children are able to grasp at what age when it comes to these sorts of subjects?
Yeah, you know, I kind of reviewed like the activity, and I think the biggest problem with the activity is that it was not age appropriate. But the thing we have to understand is that as early as age 3 or 4, children understand differences. And I think a lot of times parents are very fearful, like, why do we need to bring this in? The kids don't understand this. But kids very early on understand differences that are out there. So I think, you know, I was listening to some of the things that Merle was talking about. You know, I think it's very appropriate to teach about this, but the best way, I think, is to really infuse it throughout the curriculum. And
yes,
you can use activities, but infusing it makes it much more natural. And then the teachers actually kind of using themselves, I like, Merle, you were talking about using your first name and making it real for them. So, you know, I was really struck by that the parents were so upset about this. And I didn't see where the students were upset about this. And I think when we start talking about differences, it incites fear. And I feel like sometimes parents were fearful of talking about those kind of issues. But the reality is kids see those issues all the time. And when we talk about bias, it's very unconscious. And our unconscious is always categorizing and putting people and sorting people and creating associations. And that starts very early. Yeah, I think there are different levels of how we can teach it. Obviously, in high school, we can do a little bit more in depth. And so I think really the activity was very appropriate for college students, but maybe not appropriate for middle school students because it is a very complex issue.
I know we can't go back and second guess because that's just fruitless. However, I kind of wonder about the district itself. Has the district ever, and Meryl Johnson, chime in. I mean, is this a topic of discussion in districts? Like, how are we going to approach this really important topic, very sensitive and certainly top of mind if you look at the newspaper on any given day?
Well, I want to first mention I have a really good example of what was just said about parents creating the fear where no fear may exist.
Mm-hmm.
I got a phone call from one of my constituents in one of my in Cuyahoga County, and he was a grandfather, and he was concerned that there was a transgender child in his fourth grade grandchild's classroom. And the mom had told the granddad, you know, I'll take care of it. But granddad felt he had to call me because he was really concerned that his child was going to be upset and be harmed. And the first thing I asked him was, well, has your granddaughter come to you with any complaints or anything? And he said, well, no. And I said, well, you know, so I said, maybe she's not bothered by it. And I said, and I would hate for you to create a fear in her where she would feel she would be harmed when really none exist. And so I'm raising that because here's a little granddaughter in fourth grade with children, and kids just kind of play and accept each other usually. And here's a grandfather saying he wants to do something about it where the granddaughter doesn't seem to have really been bothered. So I thought that was an example of how sometimes, you know, parents or grandparents will instill fear when none exists. Also, I looked at the booklet that these activities came from. There were 105 pages of diversity activities, and they were for college because some of the questions talked about, are you a member of a fraternity? How many colleges have you visited lately? There was another one that talked about bungee jumping and so forth. So it seemed like the activities were designed for college students.
Well, is there enough for younger students? Antoinette, Miranda, is there enough out there? Do we know enough?
I think there is enough. And I think, you know, some of the things that Merle was bringing up, I think, are important. But part of it is about the teacher themselves feeling comfortable in talking about these issues to their students. And so while districts, I think there are many districts that understand that, you know, we need to talk about many of these issues around diversity, but I oftentimes feel that teachers themselves don't have the comfort level in even approaching some of these. And if you don't have the comfort level, I think some of your tendency is to go do an activity. But again, you don't know where the activity is going to lead. But there's a lot of materials out there that give age-appropriate ways that we can infuse it. We can infuse it during then looking at books and having students share about it. So I think there are a lot of different ways that you can do it very age appropriate, even down in kindergarten, first and second and third grade. And so I think initially it's about this appreciation of diversity and understanding that differences are out there and that they're okay.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this then. You know, the fact of the matter is Cuyahoga Falls is 91.9% Caucasian. We looked it up. And I'm wondering, what about that? What lessons do you learn in a classroom where probably almost everybody, if not all of you, are the same color? You come from the same general background. Is there, how do you begin, and what, how much depth, how depthful can the conversation get? Antoinette?
You know, when I've gone out and done diversity training and I look at elementary schools, and I know, Merle, you did high school, one of the things that I see is just about the representation in your room is a very easy one. The books that you choose, the things that you talk about. I think there's so many different ways today than there were 20 years ago to bring diversity in a natural way into your classroom. You know, just doing Black History Month, while that's great, I think it sort of marginalizes groups because it's like, this is the only time we're going to talk about that.
When, in fact, the history of the United States should be Black history.
And so I think that's a part of it. And so who's represented on your walls? Even if you don't have culturally different students in your classroom, there should be a representation in your school that reflects the United States. And so I think even in the early grades, that can be our first way of introducing diversity in a lot of different ways and then incorporating it. And then as you get to middle school and high school, you can start to have those difficult discussions. But I think even more critically with a school district that's 91%, the reality is when they get out in the real world, when they go to college, they are going to be interacting with people that are culturally different. And so when we look at how does our bias start, a lot of it starts, again, remember, it's unconscious. You start sorting. You start having association, creating associations, and they start filling in the gaps. And so a lot of this early stuff is learned by the community, by your peers, by your family. And I think parents not wanting to talk about it's like that fear of doing it. But if we're going to really be able to live in the real world, I think we do have to be able to start exposing our students to it. And that means that teachers have to understand and develop a comfort level in terms of being able to talk about these difficult issues.
Meryl Johnson?
Yes.
In a classroom where everybody's sort of the same basic color or they're coming from the same kind of place, how do you teach at that youthful age?
Same thing that Antoinette just said. I taught majority African American children, but you know, the literature is so important in the kinds of books that I had students reading. And you also have to really check the textbooks that you are using. You know, we still have textbooks that, you know, refer us to slavery as the only thing that African Americans have contributed to this country. The books that don't talk about Reconstruction and when so many African Americans were in leadership in the government and so forth. So we really have to be careful of the textbooks that we're using. You know, back when I first started teaching and throughout the years, there were back then we had, you know, VCRs and so forth. So I was really, you know, careful in what kind of videotapes I selected, the kinds of lessons I did, and it's just a matter, but I really agree with Antoinette. It's a comfort level that teachers have to be able to do this in a way that is unbiased. And that's why I said it's important for teachers to experience implicit bias training. How to do this work. It's not something you can just jump in front of a classroom and start doing.
Kelly Capitosto?
Yes, I completely agree with both Dr. Miranda and Merrill about this conversation, because even though we're talking about the tendency for implicit biases and these associations to emerge in children as early as 3 and 4 years old, children still aren't really developing that set of skills or that framework to ascribe negativity in the same way that adults do. So when we're thinking about this approach, yes, we need to provide culturally relevant examples. Yes, we need to be engaging students in these conversations from a very early age. But the focus really should be on teachers and other authority figures and mentors, because whether students are going to learn by example to either ascribe that negativity or to have that fully culturally relevant perspective is going to depend on what they're learning from those around them, which is why a lot of the work at the Kerwin Institute really focuses on being able to invest in education institutions, providing things like implicit bias trainings and having those be publicly available, because we don't want schools to have to choose between informing teachers, having this common language around implicit bias, and while simultaneously being able to invest in some of this deeper dive that both Dr. Miranda and Merrill were talking about, of really being able to change the institution and the culture itself.
Are we in a period where people are, where you're seeing districts coming to you, where you're seeing teachers coming to you, that they want to do this deeper dive right now, given the nature of the headlines and everything else swirling around?
Oh, absolutely. So we've partnered with school districts at the Kerwin Institute for quite a long time, and especially those of us that are very, you know, equity-minded folks. We really want to make sure that we're preparing our next generation to have opportunities that are better than that we had than ourselves. And I think that educational audiences automatically kind of have that mindset, so it creates a very natural partnership mm-hmm. for a lot of the implicit bias work that we've done. But what we've noticed is that, you know, even though schools are very invested, there's still a wide range of different comfortability, of different knowledge bases within those environments. So it's been very difficult for schools to get ready to take that deeper dive, because there has to be so much work in getting everyone on board at the onset. And it's not necessarily that people aren't excited about it. It's just really developing a common language, doing that really important reflective work, seeing how, you know, one's own implicit biases are informed by your backgrounds, your experiences, and really being able to use that as a way to bridge and build empathy with students and not just kind of check off a box in terms of, you know, learning about a concept. So that's really what we've been trying to do at Kerwin. Is we've recently released a series of online implicit bias modules that cater specifically to K-12 educator audiences. Because we wanted to allow them to be able to, you know, work at their own pace, see a lot of these educational resources, learn about implicit bias, but also learn about our history of race within the education system, understand, you know, what those policies are, utilizing infographics and having access to data to be able to see what are all of the linkages between one's associations and the outcomes that we're seeing, let's say, for example, in school discipline trends or access to opportunities for gifted and talented programs. We try to link all of those things together so that way schools have access to it, again, being free and publicly available. So that way, when everyone is on the same page, school districts are much more equipped to take that deeper dive and start forming interventions, start doing more personal reflection, and get into local level policies.
And you know, when you look at the amount, the disproportionate amount of African-American males who are being suspended mm-hmm. from school, when you mention discipline, I have to say this, compared to Caucasian males, this is the result of implicit bias and in some cases racism. But everyone has implicit bias. Dr. Walter Gilliam out of Yale University did one of the best examples that I've ever seen. He had four children in preschool, two white and two black, boys and girls, and he had teachers look at the students and anticipate in their minds, just to watch them play. And he said, mm-hmm. some may misbehave or whatever, just watch them play. And some may misbehave. And so what he did was, the teachers didn't know that he was keeping track of where their eyes would look, anticipating who was going to misbehave. And he did it with a red dot. And at the end of the experiment, he showed almost every red dots were on the little African-American boy, 4 years old, and the other children, the white girl, the white boy, and the African-American girl, had almost no dots on them. And these were a group of teachers of all ethnicities. So when we talk about implicit bias and people say, oh, I don't have any, that's not true. Mm. And the result of that is low expectations, which is why so many of our children are not being as successful as they deserve to be.
That sounds right. Well, Meryl Johnson, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. Thank you. It's a very important topic.
Meryl Johnson is an Ohio State Board of Education member representing District 11. Also, Antoinette Miranda, Ohio State University psychology professor. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Kelly Capitosto, Senior Research Associate at Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. I want to get a link to those webinars and so forth that people can check out when they go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Kelly, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation, Ann.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.